Popular songs in the music halls in 1910. And 10-year-old Pat Patterson was already dreaming of the day he would be at the controls of his own flying machine. 1910 was also the year that Madame La Baronne de La Roche became the first woman to receive a pilot certificate.
I'm a sky queen, oh, I'm up in the air.
In this series of The Pleasures Hours, we bring you the story of Alan Lonsdale Patterson. Pat Patterson can truly claim to be a 20th century man. Born on April the 10th, 1900, in Ottawa, Canada, he grew up surrounded by the exciting developments in aviation. That was the year they were dancing the cakewalk to Scott Joplin's music. Parlors across the world, they were singing.
She's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see. You may think she's happy and free from care. She's not, though she seems to be.
One broke out in 1914. Pat Patterson cooled his heels until his 16th birthday, then sailed for England, determined to join the Royal Flying Corps, which may sound improbable in this day and age. But let Pat tell the story.
Well, the British Air Force had a boy service and a man service. You could enlist at 16, and then when you became 18, they automatically re-enlisted you as a man service.
So you started your flying lessons at 16, and by the time you were 18, they figured you were good enough to go up and chase Germans?
It didn't make any difference that way. You learned to fly and went right into service. It was just a technicality of the age group.
Did you have to have the permission of your parents to do this?
Well, my father and mother were both dead by that time. I was raised by my grandfather, who died in 1914. But I had an uncle who was in the military service in Canada, and he arranged it.
You really were just a baby at 16, going off to fight battles.
That's what you call a baby, yeah.
Well, you were a very mature-looking baby and a very handsome one, there's no doubt about it.
I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier, recorded by Morton Harvey in 1916, the year Pat Patterson went to war.
What type of plane was it you were flying at that stage?
Well, they were World War One type of mostly bioplanes, mostly single-engine aircraft. And they didn't have much in the way of instruments in them. As the old saying goes, you flew by the seat of your pants.
And when you were involved in those dogfights, was there any way that you could save yourself if your plane was hit? Did you have a parachute to bail out?
No parachutes. It depends on how the plane was hit, whether the plane was hit or whether you were hit. If the pilot was hit, of course, that was it. But if the plane was hit, it depended on where, whether it was the engine. If you were lucky, you could make a forced landing. If some of the structure was hit, you might get away with it, you might not.
Were the losses very high from those planes?
Oh, yes. Yes, I don't know what the figures are, but they were very, very high on both sides.
What kind of weapons were in those planes?
Machine guns.
And you had to fly the plane and...
You aim the plane just as you aim the gun.
Were you ever injured that time?
Well, I had a final injury. I was in a crash, not from combat, but from failure of the engine, and I had made a forced landing in a very bad area. And the aircraft was pretty well broken up, and I put a few months in the hospital.
When we see particularly films that are made about this era, World War One, and these supposedly very romantic fights in the air, it may seem romantic now, but was it then? It seems as though you took off when the sun shone and you came back in for afternoon tea.
Well, it wasn't a... I don't know, I mean, what you call fear, but I think every man experienced a certain amount of fear, obviously.
And it was all good weather flying. You couldn't go up in any weather at all.
Well, it depended what you were on. I was mostly on observation, and we had to go up in almost any kind of weather. But I didn't stay long there. I went down to Italy on training and then went to Egypt on training.
You mean you were training other people
yes.
by that stage? Well, we hear about people like Baron von Richthofen,
right.
the Red Baron.
Well, he's a very famous, very successful one. He had, I think, the greatest number of kills of any German ace during the war. And I think that some of that was psychological on a lot of the very young pilots who hadn't very much experience. When they saw him coming with his red plane, why?
It was always a red plane he flew.
Yes.
Yes, I can imagine the effect of that. What did you do when you weren't looking after your planes or up there dogfighting and you had some kind of social life? What was it like?
Getting drunk.
Is that all?
Well, that's about all there was. There wasn't anything else.
Down in my cellar, I've been changing everything around. I got a secret hidden there, I've got it with my life. There's only one mistake I made.
Uh-oh.
I told it to my wife. Now everybody wants a key to my cellar. My cellar, folks who never even gave me a tumble. Even perfect strangers are beginning to grumble, 'cause they all want the key to open my cellar. I'd like to see 'em get one, let 'em try. You can have my money, yes sir. Take my car, take my wife if you want to go that far. But nix on a key to open my cellar if the whole damn world goes dry.
Were you far out of London?
Well, you were in places where there was very little population. Most of the airfields were removed from them. Anyway, the towns that were near them were evacuated. Mm. There were very few people.
I thought you may have been rather fated and lionized by people entertaining you because you were such romantic figures.
Well, when you went into the big city, you went back into Paris or London or Rome or somewhere like that, well, you did get entertained, but... Not in the field.
All that along, you are the only one. All that along, for you we carry on. It's been so long
since we've seen our miss. Won't you give us just one kiss? When that alarm, she takes it all in fun. She laughs and says, it really can't be done. For how can I give you my consent? When I'm true to the whole regiment. Keep singing, singing, Mademoiselle from Armentier's Parley Goo. The Mademoiselle from Armentier's Parley Goo. The Mademoiselle from Armentier's, she hasn't been kissed for 40 years. Hinky dinky Parley Goo. Hinky dinky Parley Goo.
Did you ever get into any kind of scrapes or escapades because you were fairly young at that stage?
No, not that I recall. I don't think I got into any personal scraps of any kind.
Just occasionally drunk. Was it something of a letdown then, when the war ended?
Yes, there are a lot of pub boys thought the war ended too quickly because they loved to fly, and they, of course, that ended flying for a great many of them. When they were mustered out of the service after the war, they had no place to go. They weren't trained for anything else but flying, and there were no jobs. No commercial jobs open for flying in those days before the airlines. So they roamed around the country, and that's, of course, where the barnstorming came into being.
That must have been a pretty precarious sort of existence. Did you make much of a living out of it?
We starved to death half the time.
All your money would go into caring for the plane?
Yes. Well, I had a flying circus, so-called flying circus. I had about five airplanes. We toured the eastern states of the United States, going to the fairs and exhibitions, and carrying passengers and doing stunts of one kind, aerobatics. I had a hot air balloon act with us, and the chap that owned the balloon would ride it up at night with fireworks in his hand and ride it down when it cooled. Sometimes we found him all tangled up in barbed wire. Sometimes he'd go through the sides of barns and farms and he had more broken bones than any man I've ever known.
You know, it sounds like a Mack Sennett comedy, doesn't it?
Yes. And then he would jump from parachutes also from the planes at night with Roman candles in his hand, and any kind of a stunt to draw the crowd so that we'd get passengers the next day.
How long did that man survive?
Well, he had an Arizona mountain lion also that he had trained, and the lion used to jump from the balloon.
The lion jumped from the balloon?
Yes.
From what height?
3,000 to 4,000 feet, or however high the balloon would go. Then he trained it to jump from the plane. We had a crate made that fit on the top of the wing beside the fuselage, and you put the lion in it, and then the shroud, and then the balloon would be fastened in a bag to one of the struts of the wing, and when I get generally about 2,000 feet or so over the area, where I'd pull a string which opened the bag that held the parachute, and then another string which would unlatch the door on the cage, and he'd come out. Sometimes he'd look over the side of the cockpit at me, and I don't know. Stay out of the cockpit, you go ahead and do your act. And he would. When he'd land, he would never move. Nobody could go near him but his owner. He'd come and get him. But during the latter part of the flying season, we had one more fare to make. And he was used to jump in a parachute from my from the undercarriage of the plane. And when we get over the spot that he was supposed to let go, I would reduce the engine, and I could feel him leave the airplane. And I'd go on. I could look down and see him going down the parachute. But that particular day, when I reduced the power of the engine, I felt one indication that I thought, which I thought he'd already gone, and what he had done actually was throw the parachute off and then leap after it himself, committed suicide. So that he, which we found later was because of his personal life. He had a very bad married condition. And that was the end of the season. There was no more money to make, so he decided that was it.
Times were bad. Work was unobtainable, and still the immigrants flocked to the promised land. Feelings ran high, particularly against those from Latin America, the Near and Middle East, and the Mediterranean world. The lyrics of this song, recorded in 1920, were clever, but only thinly veiled the prejudice that existed.
Columbus discovered America in 1492. Then came the English and the Dutch, the Frenchman and the Jew. Then came the Swede and the Irishman, who helped the country grow. Still they keep a-coming, and now everywhere you go, there's the Argentines and the Portuguese, the Armenians and the Greeks. One sells you papers, one shines your shoes, another shaves the whiskers off your cheeks. When you ride again in a subway train, notice who have all the seats. And you'll find they are held by the Argentines and the Portuguese and the Greeks. There's the Ritz Hotel and the Commodore and the Vanderbilt and the rest. All of them are classy, up-to-date hotels. They boast accommodations of the best. When you ask the clerk for a room and bath, he looks at you sarcastically and speaks, why, we're all filled up with the Argentines and the Portuguese and the Greeks. There's the Oldsmobile and the Humpmobile and the Cadillac and the Ford. They are the motors you and I can own, the kind most anybody can afford. But the Cunningham and the Mercedes and the Rolls-Royce Racing 3, they all belong to the Argentines and the Portuguese and the Greeks. There are pretty girls, there are witty girls, there is every kind of a girl. Some you like a little, some a little more, but none of them will set your heart awhirl. When you really feel you've met your ideal, a girl who is smart and chic, you will find she belongs to an Argentine, or a Portuguese, or a Greek. There's the Argentine and the Portuguese, the Armenian and the Greek. They don't know the language, they don't know the law, but they vote in the country of the free.
And the funny thing, when we start to sing, my country is all seen. None of us know the words but the Argentine and the Portuguese and the Greek.
That was also the end of my barnstorming era in the East. We made that fair in Iowa City. And I made arrangements with a farmer to park my airplanes on his farm for the winter. And I wanted to go west, drive west in a car. But a few days after we had the airplanes all settled down and ready to leave, a big windstorm came up and scattered them all over 50 acres of fields. So that was the end of the flying circus. And I drove west to California.
What year was that?
1919.
So you were 19 years old?
I'll correct that, it was 1920.
So it was a case of go west, young man, and find your fortune.
Yes. I arrived and took me almost 6 weeks to drive because the highways in those days weren't completed, and it was dirt road. We had to cross. Some cases we had to get a farmer to hook up horses and drag the car through the streams, then spend a couple of days cleaning it out. So it was quite a job to drive.
And there weren't such things.
Transcontinental.
Yeah. There weren't such things as motels and gas stations.
No, we slept.
Roadside toilets.
We slept in the car. So when I arrived in Los Angeles, I went to the only airport there, which is Cecil B. DeMille Airport. And I asked for a job, and they said, we haven't any jobs here. We're starving to death ourselves. We're up to San Francisco. There's an outfit up there doing a lot of work. So we drove up to San Francisco and found the same condition up there. So we returned to Los Angeles and went back to Cecil B. DeMille Field and finally talked them into putting me on. Now, the Cecil B. DeMille Field was located at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and La Brea, which is now the center of Hollywood. And they moved out on Wilshire Boulevard later on. But that was at an area which used to smell so bad because there was some stuff bubbling up out of the ground.
And it was black in color, wasn't it?
Yes, it was black in color, and it's now a big oil field. I stayed with Cecil B. DeMille Field until it decided to move out to Western Avenue, which was out a little town by the name of Gardena. And so I went out and found some property next to it and started my own airport. And we carried passengers from there to over to see the ocean at $2.50 and peacefully starved to death there, but we managed to get by somehow.
Were there very many regulations that controlled you then?
No regulations. Before the civil aeronautics became into being.
So the passengers were really taking their lives into their hands as well?
Certainly.
Were there many accidents, particularly, say, in the barnstorming days when you took people up in country towns?
Oh, yes, we lost airplanes every once in a while.
But a lot of people as well?
Passengers. Generally due to motor failure, because the motors weren't very trustworthy in those days. But at the Western Avenue Field, we had very few accidents. And I had two incidents there that are worth noting. There was a evangelist by the name of Amy Semple McPherson, and she decided one day that she wanted to go to San Francisco, and she wanted to be near God, so she wanted to fly all the way. So she came out to the airport and made arrangements and said it had to be very secret because she didn't want her flock to know. So we made a date to fly her from my field up to San Francisco. Now the airplanes we're using in those days were the old World War I training planes that were called the Jenny. And they weren't very powerful, and they really couldn't go very high in them. And there's one area where ridge that we had to get over to get out of Los Angeles and called the Ridge Route. And so I told her she couldn't bring any baggage or anything because she was a fairly good-sized woman herself. But we made the date to leave at 6:30 in the morning. But the secret had gotten out, and several hundred of her flock followed her out. I put her in the front cockpit and the back. But to get ahead of my story, the field that I had was called Mushroom Flats. It was all flat adobe, and when it rained, the mushrooms would come up overnight, and people would come in by the hundreds to pick them. We had just gone through 2 days of that, and adobe is a hard clay, and when it dries, it opens up and cracks. So we worked all night filling all the cracks in the strip that I was to take off the next morning. But evidently we missed one, because before I had flying speed, a wheel dropped in a crack and we went over on our back. Nobody hurt. I got Amy Semple out of the cockpit, and of course her flock was coming running over, howling and screaming, "Kill me." So I took off and ran the other way across the field and hid in the farmhouse all day. And that was the end of that episode.
You didn't fly her after all? No.
The airplane went over and back. And
I thought you may have put her into another plane.
Her flock wouldn't let her.
Oh, I see. Did you ever talk to her or know much about her?
No, just that during the negotiations for that flight, that's all.
Did you form
but
any...
She was quite a character. I went to one of her meetings, and she had ropes across pinned on the back of the chairs. When they took her collection, you put your money on the rope. You couldn't hang coins on a rope. They had pins so you can pin your paper money on the rope.
Well, she made enough to build a big temple, didn't she?
Oh, yes, she made. Became a very wealthy woman. I don't know what happened to her later, but...
Well, she went through some very strange escapades, generally involving sex. But did you know something? Do you know that her first husband is buried here in the Colonial Cemetery in Hong Kong?
No, I didn't.
There's a tombstone there, Captain James McPherson, husband of Amy Semple McPherson.
I never knew that she even had a husband. Her mother was her boss, of course. She was the one that organized everything.
Was she great as a preacher? She must have stirred
up. Yes, she hypnotized the whole crowd.
Amy Semple McPherson was raking in the shekels from her flock on the West Coast, bandleader Paul Whiteman wasn't doing too badly in 1920 with this hit, which he played nightly in New York's Ambassador Hotel, whispering.
In Abner Field, when Howard Hughes started to make his Hell's Angels picture, he needed a lot of World War One airplanes, and there weren't too many in the States. So we would alter what we had, the American World War One airplanes, to look similar to the British or the German planes, and I contracted to convert 5 or 6 of them. And Hughes used to come out and every once in a while and take a look, see what we were doing, everything all right. And during that time, there was a motorcycle cop on that beat. And on Sundays, he used to stop in and help us try to attract the crowd and work around, and it was very handy. And one day he drove out, one Sunday he drove out, and there was a girl in the back of his bike. Very attractive young lady, and he told us that she'd help sell tickets for us. So she did that for quite a few Sundays. And one Sunday, when she was there, Hughes came out and said, "Who's the girl?" And I said, "Well, she's here to help us." And he said, "I'd like to talk to her." So he did, talked to her for quite a while, and last I saw her, she was in his Rolls Royce going back to Los Angeles. And at that time, his first lead in a picture, I forget her name, was very difficult, and they were just changing from silent to sound. So he got rid of her and was looking for another replacement. And this girl became the replacement, Jean Harlow. She was a very, very attractive girl. Very sexy girl, of course. I read all the books about her that they print. I think there are 3 of them. And none of them ever picked up this connection with a motorcycle policeman, which she was living with at that time.
It seems as though that was Hughes' habit, wasn't it? The way he found stars, actresses. What was he like? Was he slightly strange when you knew him, or was he just a genius?
No, at that time he was very, very easy to get along with, very congenial, very, very likable chap. It was only after he crashed that Pursuit that he was building and cracked his skull. Then his personality changed completely. He was a genius, there's no question about that. After he crashed that airplane and fractured his skull, he was entirely different. He was a member of our Quiet Birdman organization, and he used to send us tickets to all his movies and whatnot, and donated a lot of things to the organization. And after that, we never heard from him.
And no one ever thought that the accident was what changed his personality.
I don't know. As far as we were concerned, it certainly certainly was the cause.
And here is Jean Harlow with James Cagney in an excerpt from the film The Public Enemy, made in 1931.
I guess I'll call up Gwen. She ought to be home by now.
Now, you stay put if you know what that means. Oh, my bashful boy. You are different, Tommy. Very different. And I've discovered it isn't only a difference in manner and outward appearances. It's a difference in basic character. The men I know, and I've known dozens of them, oh, they're so nice, so polished, so considerate. Most women like that type. I guess they're afraid of the other kind. I thought I was, too. But you're so strong. You don't give, you take. Oh, Tommy, I could love you to death.
Well, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh, look, the moon is on fire. Comes all the keen in my flying machine. Going up, going up. Goodbye.
I hope you'll join us next week at the same time for the second episode in this series of The Pleasure's Ours, covering the life of aviator Pat Patterson.
Whoa, dear, don't hit the moon. No, girl, not yet, but soon, this for me. Oh, my, you're a shy queen, not I. I'm a sky queen. Oh, I'm up in the air about this for a fair. Comes all the scene in my flying machine. Going up, she goes, she goes. Balance yourself like a bird on a beam. In the air she goes, well, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh, look, the moon is on fire. Comes all the scene in my flying machine. Going up, goodbye. Comes all the scene in my flying machine. Going up, she goes, she goes. Balance yourself like a bird on a beam. In the air she goes, well, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh, look, the moon is on fire. Comes all the scene in my flying machine. Going up,